Welcome to Changing Currents, Climate Conversations in South Yorkshire. In this series, we explore climate perspectives and possible futures with local communities, bringing different practices into conversation around local environmental issues. By focusing on actions and connections, we intend to give a sense of how working on a local scale can create positive social and environmental change. For this episode, we are situated in Sheffield, the Peak District, and we'll focus on themes of land access, healing, and organising. We also cover topics of racial and gendered trauma and would like to offer a trigger warning and ask that if you find any of the content difficult, please do what you need to keep yourself safe. Our friend Nadia Sheikh was due to join us for this recording but couldn't make it. You can find out more about Nadia and her work with the Right to Roam campaign at www.righttoroam.org.uk. My name's Evie Muir, my pronouns are she and her, and I'm a domestic abuse specialist, writer and founder of Peaks of Colour, a Peak District-based nature for healing club by and for people of colour. Through our monthly hikes and regular workshops, we explore alternative nature-based routes to healing and justice outside of carceral white supremacist models.
I'm Haran, pronouns he, him. I'm an artist and writer based in London. I currently live on a small narrow boat on the Grand Union Canal, and I'm working as an associate artist with Greenpeace UK. So looking at the intersection of art and activism and what those two disciplines can offer and learn from each other. And with Art Catalyst, I'm working on a community garden for Mind Sheffield that I've been sort of co-developing, repairing, doing some growing on for the last 12 months.
I'm Jasmine. I am a sort of climate change and soil scientist. So my research sort of looks at carbon cycling in Arctic ecosystems and also here in the Peak District, looking at upland grasslands. So I sort of came to this practice from a place of justice and growing up with climate change sort of all around. I always saw it as something that would affect people and lives and homes rather than just like panda bears and polar bears.
Yeah, so I'm Max Olayamba. I wear several hats, really. I'm an ecocentrist, an academic environmental journalist, an activist, and then also a founder and managing director of a charity I set up called Sheffield Environmental Movement in 2016. So I call myself literally a pracademic. That means much of my research I do is informed by the work I do practically in communities. And my research looks at the trajectory of race, ecology, and environmental justice in the UK. And so basically I look at contested landscapes and the role people of Black African ancestry who have been here for centuries have been written out of the landscape. And to see how the Julian Global Review, which is the government policy to look at inclusion and diversity within countryside spaces, can be made more effective and impactable within communities I represent.
Environmental justice questions are just that. It's a collection of questions shared with me by artists, scholars, activists, scientists, horticulturalists, archaeologists. And the premise is that this collection of questions can function as a conversation generator and a stimulant to debate and thinking, associative and divergent thinking around questions of environmental climate justice and futurity.
So for those listening who can't see the setup we have around us today, we've got some of the questions and the cards laid out in front of us. They're beautifully designed cards on white paper with black text and black illustrations. and they all have different creative and lyrical and pragmatic questions for us to choose from. So all of us are going to choose one question each that we'll answer, and we're going to take a couple outside as well. It's a really snowy day in the Peak District today, so we're going to brave the elements.
So I'm going for this question here. What would a balanced system of replenishment and extraction look like in your local ecosystem, uncode? That's the question. So obviously I have chosen this question because I think ecosystems play a vital role in our very existence in communities all over. The problem we have when it comes to ecosystems extraction is the fact that we live in an anthropogenic world or anthropogenic society where basically the finite resources which ecosystems are meant to provide for life sustenance are being depleted in a more consumerist way without really taking into account we are destroying our very existence. And I suppose the problem we have here is the fact that ecosystems have been perceived in a very narrow way in Western societies where nature is seen as a consumable commodity. So the commodification of nature has been taking place for centuries now in Western societies, and actually that has impacted on how communities that have even migrated from other parts of the world where they live close to nature and had a kind of biocentric view of nature have come and have also bought into that narrative in terms of how ecosystems are perceived. And then secondly, there's that issue of cultural severance, really, in terms of how people are disconnected from ecosystem services. Say, for example, most communities I work with in Sheffield doesn't even know where the water that comes into their taps come from. And actually, the water where we are sitting now in the Peak District National Park, the water, when it rains, trapped in the peaks, then extracted in the reservoirs and treated, and then it is then provided into houses in Sheffield and surrounding areas. And with climate change happening now, it's impacting on water supply in most communities now, and yet people don't know where their source of water comes from. So I suppose it's important that this whole issue of climate change, which is then linked up into livelihoods, is brought home to people who are disconnected from the whole discourse in nature and environment. Yeah.
Thinking about the question, I was wondering, how do we define what is local? Because perhaps it's also a question of borders, and how do you create borders? Of course, borders are fictions, but to have this sense of where you're replenishing and where you're extracting from, to what degree do we need some kind of line to delineate what is the space we're intending to care for?
I think that's a good question, but I suppose the fact is, when if you look at the whole natural discourse, you find the communities that we want to advocate on behalf of have been disempowered to have a say or a voice in how ecosystem services function. And I suppose this debate we are having here now is to look at how we can empower people in local communities to play a part or a role in taking control of these ecosystem services that we're talking about. But how can we do that if we don't provide them with the tools and the knowledge to be able to contribute to that? Without that, I think basically it's still in the hands of the scientists or the environmentalists who think they have got, you know, all the knowledge and the skills, you know, to dictate to people. And I suppose we want to break that. We want to change that.
Sort of on a practical note, I've seen really nice examples of sort of grassroots movements looking at things like libraries of things, where you sort of challenge consumption and you have these places where you just have collections of like tools and camping equipment instead of going out and buying new items and like properties shared within local communities. And they're nice like examples of how like people can be empowered to sort of like change consumption patterns.
Yeah, and I think for me, language like extraction and replenishment springs to mind one thing, and that's decolonization, essentially, and colonial extraction, and the question of who extracts what from who, and then who replenishes. So I think a balanced system of this would look like one that is putting decolonial practice and embedding that into the ways that we approach our relationship with the land, our relationship with our local communities, and one that does think outside the box and one that's creative and challenges those systems of power that are upheld by colonialism and neocolonialism that Maxwell spoke about, that we still see kind of regurgitated today.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up a card. So I'm going to pick this one. So it says, how can we organise like mycelium? And as a lover of soil, I love this question. Mycelium are just like so, so cool. And the more we learn about them, the more it challenges our sort of preconceived ideas of what even is an organism. Fungi is sort of broadly split into two sort of categories. So you've got mycorrhiza fungi and eusaprotrophic fungi. So your mycorrhiza fungi, they're like really good partnership and traders. They connect to the ends of roots and go out into the soil, and the plants will make sugars and then pass these sugars to their partner mycorrhiza, and then they take that sugar and they go out and they look for nutrients and then pass that back. So there's this like reciprocal trading going on where there's this partnership between these two organisms. And then the mycelia also connect up different trees to each other. It's sort of like this idea of like cooperation and trading. And I think it's something that we really lack in sort of Western society. There's this emphasis on competition, and that's not got us to a very good place. And then the sort of other sort of group of fungi is the eusaprotrophic fungi. So these are like great recyclers. These recycle all of the dead and decaying material in the soil, and they break it all down so lots of other organisms and creatures can use it. And I think these two ideas of like partnership, cooperation and trade, and recycling and like processing waste in a circular way are great ways to sort of structure society. And then sort of like overall, with these like ecosystems, we found that the more biodiverse they are, the more resilient they are.
Yeah, I would agree. And yet I'm agreeing with a lot less sophisticated language and understanding of kind of, yeah, the ecology of it. But one thing I'm really interested in is, well, exactly as the question says, how can we organise like mycelium? And it's coming from the position of the belief that I believe that we can. So with Peaks of Colour, one thing I'd love to set up in the future is a mycelium movement or a mycelium network of organisers, of experts, of thinkers, of doers that can essentially explore what a mycelium network within community would look like. These thoughts are already in motion in different parts of society and across our communities, particularly in abolitionist communities and through abolitionist activisms, where the concept of community care comes up time and time again as an alternative to the systems we're currently existing in. Yeah, nature's alternatives to what we currently have allow us to flourish and allow us to nurture each other in ways that across the board we aren't really doing at the minute. And yeah, it comes back down to that idea of an abolitionist future and what is an alternative and how could we imagine our existence beyond what currently is.
I mean, I agree with what Yasmin said, because I mean, as a scientist, I think basically what scientists have done, they failed communities in terms of the knowledge they've got. They've rather used their knowledge as a tool of power, right, to oppress communities. And I think, you know, when you look at taxonomy, for example, basically people haven't got, we don't know what taxonomy is. And if you can't identify the very common flora and fauna or species out there, how can you really relate to them?
what is the sexiest thing the land has ever done? Backstory. So I'm a domestic abuse survivor, threefold, and a domestic abuse practitioner, educator, whatever language you want to use for it, the professionalisation of it. The thing that really underpins, you know, if we go into schools and teach about safe sex or sex education or, you know, domestic abuse and sexual violence, the thing that really underpins it is consent. And I think in many ways, that's what the land gives to not just me, but so many of us, in the sense of consent and agency, and consent to be who we authentically are, who we most wildly are. And, you know, there's kind of feminist slogans around on social media that's like, consent is sexy. And I believe that of nature, that the fact that you can step out your door and be in a green space and be whoever you need to be in that moment, whether it is a crying mess or just this liberated kind of running free body that's embracing the world around you. It's that element of freedom and liberation and, yeah, agency and autonomy that we think of when we think of consent in a sexual relationship context. But I get that from nature. And I think I probably got that from nature before I ever got it from a human. And to me, that's sexy.
I think that's so beautiful. And I really resonate with that. Like, nature's always been a space for me where I felt free to be whoever I am. Also frees me from a lot of stress as well. When I go out into nature, being able to like look out at the land and like an expanse, there's like a calmness that comes to me. Also to be so grateful for everything that nature and the land provides for us, even so much as like most of our food comes from the land. Most of that food then ends up as like the building blocks of ourselves and who we are. And then when we die, we then return to the land. So it's sort of like a place that like gives us life and then recycles us, and then we give life to something else.
I don't see the land being sexy. I think it depends on who you are, and it has to do with, I go back to how the theory of production of space, in how you find yourself in a particular space and how you make that sense of belonging to that space. That's where it becomes sexy. But if you are not seen as part of that space, then obviously it becomes threatening. And that is why communities we work in, you know, when it comes to contested landscapes, you find that most people see nature as same, but they can't access those spaces because those spaces are out of boundaries for them because of their race or their ethnicity or their class or their gender. And to me, I think space production is quite crucial when we talk about advocating on behalf of people who have been marginalized and disconnected from the natural world. So when you, I have a favorite theorist, Henri Lefebvre, who's written the theory of production of space, and he talks about how spaces can be threatening and some spaces can be very welcoming. So to make the land more sexy is, how do we make spaces attractive? How do we make spaces inclusive? How do we make spaces diverse? Same. How do we ensure that people feel that going to that space makes them, it's a therapy for them to go and imbue themselves in that space to get all the good elements that nature provides for their health and well-being. Not until we make spaces more inclusive and acceptable, then obviously the land cannot be sexy. And we find that the land in England actually is not green and pleasant as it's purported to be, because this land is crying, for healing. This land has to be healed, because a lot of enslaved people have died living on this land to make this country what it is, especially the country, rural countryside, where we have national trust properties, one we are sitting in now. All these structures were built out of slave labor. So how can the land be sexy when there are spirits which are crying for the kind of torture, murder, looting and all that went through during the British Empire and during times of colonial enslavement. So as activists and advocates, you know, we have to educate people to understand that the land needs reparation. Reparations are quite important to make the land sexy. Nothing can be sexy if it doesn't provide therapy to the human being.
One of the things that fascinates me about the question is by asking about what the land has done, it encourages you to think about landscape in terms of time and events rather than place, like the place you go to. So I just started to think in terms of all the fluctuating qualities different parts of a landscape can offer, from the volcanic eruption to the swamp, to the geyser, to the fissures, to cracks in ice. And so perhaps it's this multiplicity and variety of capacities that is what's so seductive, like that it can be so many things simultaneously. And while some person is enjoying rolling in snow, someone else is like sinking their hand into a desert and feeling warm sand around them, but it's all happening parallel. So it's this giver of pleasure to multiple bodies at multiple instances over thousands, millions of years. And that's just what it's offered to humans, let alone the other pleasures for other species. Yeah. Yeah.
That's very sexy.
Should cultural institutions push for radical land reform? I think it depends on which institution. I'm not sure if it's a blanket imposition on all cultural institutions, because some are better suited to doing that kind of work than others. Or maybe there's a question of at what scale or what scales can land reform operate, so that if you're a small co-op of four people, then what's your work in relation to, say, a much better funded opera house?
What is the role of these cultural institutions, especially like moving forward? Like how do they want to define themselves? Like what does society want from them? You know, a lot of cultural institutions are there to share and disseminate knowledge and culture for the benefit of everyone and the benefit of society. And there's so much knowledge about how the way we're managing land and how access to land has been historically organised, how it isn't beneficial for everyone and how it actually only benefits a certain sect in society.
So I'm going to bring it back initially to the idea of police reform. And we know that in conversations around police reform, the question is police reform or police abolition. And I think there's probably a similar question to be asked here of, are we wanting reform or are we wanting the status quo to be abolished and new possibilities to be instated in its place? And then if the answer is it's the latter, then again, who the cultural institutions are and what their role is must then come into question, because we know that when it comes down to reform, it's a case of existing institutions essentially changing and doing their best, and often we don't feel like that's enough. So then if we're talking about abolition, radical land abolition, some of these cultural institutions should no longer exist. And that then opens up another question of which ones stay and which ones go. Again, which ones are the most suitable and the most equipped to remain and to evolve in a way that doesn't continue upholding a white capitalist hegemony and who is willing to revoke that power in order to be sustainable? Because, yeah, somehow radical land reform is a bit of, yeah, it can't be radical and reforming, some would argue. Maybe I would argue that too.
Well, if I think what you said is true, from my experience, it has to do with organizational culture, basically, in this country, how they've been constituted to have a very Eurocentric way of looking at land, and how people from other minoritized communities have a role to play in that land, what is their stake in that land, how are they viewed in that land, in terms of when I talk about land of the spaces, as we speak here in the Pictish National Park. And not until these organizational cultures, which have been baked into what we call whiteness, or what are called the white racial frame, which defines how landscapes are perceived or seem to perceive within minoritized communities, where these what we call the Rua Idol, where basically the Rua Idol is seen as a space where the land belongs to white people, and therefore seeing black faces or minoritized faces in that land or in that space is seen to be out of place. And the institutions like the national parks, the Wildlife Trust, the National Trust, which are meant really to democratize and de-racialize the way these lands are looked at by the people who patronize as their members. Not until the organization, of course, changed, but from board of trustees, volunteers, staff, to make these spaces more equitable and more accessible, and to reflect them to be more diverse and equal, but to, instead of seeing that white racial frame that has been historically associated with these spaces, then land reform will forever remain an uphill task. And so we have an organization called LION, Land in Our Names, which is basically based in London, and they have been fighting for land reparation and reforms, and it's been an uphill battle, because like I said, land is wealth, land is property, and those who own the land own the law, because the law is always on their side. Those who own the land, they make the laws in Parliament, House of Lords, where these bills are passed through. So how will they want these reforms to go? Because if these reforms happen, then it's going to take away their power and their privilege. So to me, the only way around land reform is what we are doing in terms of organizing, mobilizing, campaigning, advocating. It doesn't matter your race, it doesn't matter your class, your ethnicity. It's a question of believing that the land belongs to all of us and we all have a stake in this land. To me, that's what land reform should be about.
So, what does land justice smell, taste, and feel like?
Do you want to go first? It's a hard one, actually.
Well, it's an abstraction, isn't it? So, I guess the justice is yet to come. So it's also a question of what is the flavour of the future, right?
Oh my gosh.
But it's something that we're imagining will feel liberatory and pleasurable. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's about pairing those flavours and sensations with things we recognise now and then casting a net forward.
It's quite an exciting question, and then it's also a bit sad, isn't it? Because when you realise that we haven't experienced justice, so we don't know. So there's an element of just like sitting with that, I think.
I was also thinking about this feeling of absences because so much of land justice or questions of rights to roam is like crossing lines, crossing borders, going through gates. And so perhaps the absence of certain boundaries.
Yeah, and that's freedom, isn't it?
Would be the feeling, like the kind of lack of pushing through something or the lack of unlocking something.
I think there's the feeling of, like, you know, exhilaration, risk-taking, anxiety, fear, joy, excitement, exhaustion, all of those things that come with organising and that come with, yeah, wanting to make a change and wanting to be around safety and joy. We take for granted that it's easy or that it should be easy. It's not, and we know it's not. So it feels uncomfortable. Land justice feels uncomfortable. It tastes uncomfortable. It tastes bitter, tastes sour.
I guess it's useful to think more of justice as a process rather than a destination.
A journey,
point.
Yeah.
With different flavours and textures and sensations along the way.
Especially, you know, even on a day-to-day basis, justice feels and tastes and smells different because I can wake up one morning with so much motivation and excitement and I have nothing but thrilling interactions with people, like today, where there's nothing but, you know, safety and joy and hope that comes out of it, and then I could wake up the next day and it feels really hard and it feels like an uphill battle. And yeah, and for whatever reason, for many reasons, I'll be reminded of the bitterness and the rancidness. So I guess our answer is it's a journey and it's varied.
Or a fresh snowball.
Or a fresh snowball. I like that.
So what does land justice smell, taste and feel like? Oh, this is, yeah, it's a hard one because it's almost something that's, yeah, we've not experienced it properly. But I guess the first sort of feeling that comes to mind is, like, you know, when your friend or family member is giving you like a pep talk and then something's gone on and they're trying to uplift you and they give you that hug that sort of like lifts you, and it's like a hug that says, you know, you got this, like I'm giving you strength and courage. And like, I guess that's sort of what I feel like it is. It's like, it's such a journey that we've got to go on to get to the destination, and maybe it's about the journey and it's not about, you know, constantly evolving what we define as justice. And then a sort of kind of more sillier analogy would be, smells like popcorn. So like, for me, like, sort of land justice is balancing so many different needs: the needs of the environment, the needs of the people, the needs of the economy, needs of culture. And like, when I make popcorn, I'm always trying to get that sweet spot of like, all of the kernels are popped, but they're not too burnt. And it's like, you have to really be careful to like not tip that popcorn cooking over the edge.
That's quite a good analogy you used there, the popcorn.
Thank you.
Suppose land to me is life. Land gives life. Land takes away life. So to taste and smell and feel life is to understand land. And how do we understand land if we are disconnected from that land? So the only way to understand land is to reconnect with land. But if people have been historically, culturally severed or detached from land due to the trajectory of migration, then land becomes a distant issue in their lives. We are working at the moment on a piece of land that many, many, many years ago we wouldn't have been allowed to walk, and that is in the Pygdis National Park, which was owned by the Duke of Rufland, where basically he owned whole estates, which was used for deer hunting, and people were not allowed to access this place. And so you can imagine, not until the mass trespass in 1932, you know, when they would brief working class people, advocate for access, which allowed us now to be able to walk on this land, to smell it and taste it, and to feel a sense of belonging to this land, to connect to this land, to appreciate this land, to feel that we are immersed in this land. Without those brave working class people, we wouldn't be able to pace this on this land and smell and benefit the health properties that we get from walking in this space, the fresh air that we breathe. Because remember, we live in the polluted cities in Sheffield, where the air is heavily polluted. But here, just stop and breathe in the air. So fresh, so beautiful, so relaxing. And look at how siren it is. How peaceful. Very peaceful. Very enticing. Tranquil. What else can you ask from the land?
Thank you for listening. Changing Currents, Climate Conversations in South Yorkshire is a Radio Arts Catalyst production. The series producer is Kitty Turner, with sound design by Ashley Holmes. Arts Catalyst is a visual arts organisation based in Sheffield, South Yorkshire. We develop creative projects connected to the world around us. If you'd like to find out more about our work, please visit our website at www.artscatalyst.org. A special thank you to all those who took part in creating this series, and thank you to National Trust for their support of the Sheffield episode, which took place at the Longshore Estate. The series was made possible through funding from the South Yorkshire Mayoral Combined Authority. The Mayor, MCA and LEP have a shared purpose to create a stronger, greener, fairer South Yorkshire, to work together to unlock the potential of South Yorkshire people, businesses and places and ensure they prosper. Radio Arts Catalyst is supported by Arts Council England.